Welcome to the Food Matters Live podcast, where we showcase the innovations, the big ideas, and the visionaries in the food industry. We dig deep, we look to the future and the past, and we question everything that we think we know about food. I'm Stephen Gates. I'm a food science writer, TV presenter, and a gastronaut. Now, food inflation is a huge concern across the globe. Over the course of 2022, food prices were on average 14.3% higher than the year before. In the UK, things are looking a little worse than average. The Office for National Statistics found that in the 12 months leading up to March 2023, food prices rose 19.2%. And my salary certainly didn't raise that. Now, the thing is, the World Bank is reporting that globally, wholesale prices are starting to fall. And in this episode, we'll explore the implications of high food prices on consumers, businesses, and the broader food industry. And we'll discuss when we might see a drop in prices and ask, why are food prices still so high? Well, with me to delve into this topic are two absolutely fantastic guests. Dr. Liliana Danila is lead economist at the Food and Drink Federation. Hello there, Liliana.
Hi, Stefan. Thank you for having me.
Oh, that's a great pleasure. Now, Rachelle Erica is senior economist at the Joseph Rowntree Foundation. Hello, Rachelle.
Hello.
Let's start off by getting a little bit of perspective here. Now, 2 weeks ago, Mel Stride, Secretary of State for Work and Pensions, falsely claimed that the inflation rate in Germany, Portugal and Sweden was higher than in the UK. In fact, the UK's inflation rate was around 19% compared to 17% in Sweden and Germany and only 15% in Portugal. It was a bizarre lie to tell to Radio 4, but I suppose it does highlight that food inflation has been high across Europe. All inflation has been high across Europe. Now, we're recording this on the 6th of July, 2023. So currently, Liliana, how does UK food inflation compare to other countries?
Right. So I would just like to first mention that the most recent data that we have available are for May. Mm-hmm. And in May, food inflation in the UK was at 18.4. So we have seen a deceleration since the 19.1 or the previous 19.2 in March. But in terms of how it compares to other European countries, indeed, UK food inflation recently, in recent months, has been higher than inflation in other European countries. However, prices in the UK are still lower than they are in many European countries. If I'm to give you the statistics, in May, there were 23 countries in Europe that were more expensive in terms of food than UK was.
When you say more expensive, can you give us a bit of context? Is that in relation to average income?
No, in terms of, so the way prices are computed, both Eurostat, which is the EU statistical body, and the ONS are computing a index for prices based on 2015. So you can compare prices across countries. So it's really prices which are based in each country on more or less a similar basket. And therefore, we can compare realistically and credibly prices between countries. So that's what I'm referring to. And in May, prices in the EU were 5% pricier than in the UK, or prices in Germany were 7% pricier than in the UK. In other words, what's happening is that while UK prices are lower than in many European countries, the fact that we see higher inflation, so we see prices rising at a faster pace, it means that wedge is getting smaller and smaller.
The difference. Yeah.
The difference, yes.
Gotcha.
There are a few specific factors that is happening. One has to do with the recent energy shock, and we've seen over the last year higher energy costs in the UK compared to Europe. I mean, Europe also had a massive shock. But we were hit harder, and our sector, the food manufacturing sector, is energy intensive. We have seen problems with the labor market, right? We have a tighter labor market than many other European countries, and that has an impact. And then also, we were a bit more exposed to trade with North Africa and Southern Europe, and when we had those months of bad weather in the beginning of the year that also pushed prices a bit more here than in Europe.
So the big question really is, what is the impact of this? So Rochelle, what effects have we seen on consumers in the UK so far?
Yeah, so there's a real split in terms of what we've seen in terms of who is most impacted. And I think everyone across the UK has probably noticed that their food bill has been rising. You know, you go to the grocery shop and you're thinking, oh, is that all I'm getting for, you know, £10, £20, £80? Yeah. That feels like a lot less than what I was getting last time, both in terms of price, but also probably in terms of like the quantity of products as well. So everyone is definitely feeling that impact. But if you're on a low income, you are disproportionately feeling that impact. And that's because your food bill takes up a much higher proportion of your income than if you're on a high income. So at the Joseph Rowntree Foundation, our research focuses on lower income households. And we have got new data from a big piece of research where we've been tracking the impacts of the cost of living crisis through a tracker. And so in May, what we found is that 5.7 million low income households across the UK said that in the past month, they'd experienced food insecurity, which meant that they didn't have enough money not to be going hungry, or not to be cutting down the size of or skipping their meals, which is really, really significant. And just to note that that's happening despite, you know, a huge amount of government support going in terms of helping, you know, to address the cost of living crisis as well. That was at the same time as an additional £300 has hit the bank accounts of those on means-tested benefits, as well as sort of other boosts to income, like benefits being uprated with inflation, as well as sort of energy price support over the winter. So all of this is happening despite that, and it's showing it has a really, really big impact on what people can afford to buy. And the prices of some goods are rising much faster than other goods. So, for example, the prices of fresh fruits and vegetables are rising much faster than, for example, like the price of biscuits or sort of like cheaper carbs to fill up on. And that's what we're seeing that lower income households are having to do. They're forced into having a much poorer diet nutritionally. So it's having a huge impact, not just on, I guess, your budget at the end of the day, but also on whether or not you're going without and you're having to make really sort of impossible trade-offs around the nutritional value that your family gets as well.
Yeah. So that's, I guess that's the big question then, Rochelle. So what is the impact of food insecurity? Is it nutritional? Is it stress? Is it lifestyle related or medical? What are the big impacts that you see?
Yeah, so it's all of those things. So it's the nutritional impact of not having the food that you need. And something that we're quite concerned about as well is that that is happening for a lot of families with children too. Or if you've got family members with certain dietary requirements because they're sick, you know, for example, cancer patients might have a different kind of diet that's required to help make their life better as they go through that illness. So we're seeing, for example, that over 4 in 10 low-income households with children have had to reduce their spending on food for their children. Now, that will really come into play when free school meals, you know, end over some holidays and things. So that's a big question. The impact on health is significant. So our data shows that through the cost of living crisis, those who are going without essentials like food are much more likely to have reported physical, mental health or other health and well-being impacts like loss of sleep or needing to access the NHS. So this has a big sort of flow-on impact for that as well. There's the nutritional point, but it's also the stress of knowing that you don't have enough money to put the right kind of food or enough food on the table for you and your family, and the worry about not being able to afford essentials at the same time as you're likely, if you can't afford enough for food, you're also likely to be, you know, falling behind on other bills as well.
Yeah.
And that has a huge sort of flow on impact.
Yeah. So, I mean, this is multifactorial problems that end up compounding each other.
Yeah. And what we found in our research as well was that if you are going without food, you're highly likely to be going without other essentials as well. You know, not able to afford essential transport journeys, not able to afford the right kind of toiletries for your family, unable to, you know, afford enough, you know, have enough money to make sure that everyone is having showers and baths every day. There are massive impacts of rising inflation across the board when incomes just aren't keeping up and if households don't have the savings buffer to fall back on.
Yeah, and not to be too venal about it, I mean, these will end up having costs to society in so many different
Absolutely.
Ways as well. Okay. Liliana, have the FDF seen this same drift where fresh foods and vegetables have risen in price more than the more processed foods? And if so, is there any root cause of that?
Right. So what we have seen, we are using data from the ONS, the Office for National Statistics, is indeed that some items which require less processing, such as, olive oil or milk, have indeed had higher rises than other kind of goods. Mm. I think that has to do with some sector-specific factors, like olive oil is very clear. There were very, very bad crops, so it's just a lower supply out there. But it also has to do with the massive turbulence, which I guess we are all aware that the industry has seen over the last 3-4 years. We had seen 3 structural shocks, massive shocks in quick succession, right? So we had Brexit, which increased the red tape for our trade. And our sector was disproportionately impacted because 60% of our trade comes or is done with Europe, with EU, yeah. Right? So that meant that our sector had seen a bigger cost from Brexit.
It's almost as though Brexit's a bad idea, isn't it? Moving on.
Then we've had the pandemic, right? The pandemic, again, everybody was impacted by the pandemic, every household, but also every business. But again, our business, our industry was impacted disproportionately. On the one hand, right when the pandemic started, our members and, all food manufacturers had to shift their business model where now they couldn't supply anymore to the hospitality. We were under a lockdown, right? They had to reroute to supply to supermarkets and then to reverse that in the span of 2 years. So that in itself was quite an undertaking, but it was an impressive undertaking if we think, right? I mean, we had those 3 weeks where everybody was panicky and buying everything they could off the shelves, but then everybody saw that it was that supply was coming through, right? That we were a resilient industry and we were able to adjust quite quickly.
But it required systemic change.
It required systemic change, yes, which was quite pricey also. And then that was followed by the substantial rises in costs, right? From cost of global shipping, logistics. It was in the summer of 2020 when agricultural commodity prices started rising. Mainly was due to a very large increase in demand from China. They were building their food reserves. But nevertheless, there were this massive increase in costs that had started due to the pandemic. And then just when we thought we were pretty much, coming at the other end and things were starting to settle down, we had the invasion of Ukraine, which meant that certain ingredients now were inaccessible, right? Ukraine was a massive exporter of cereals, mainly wheat and barley, but also of different oils. And the cut of gas supplies to Europe impacted not only, right, the energy supply, but also it had this other impacts on the fertilizer markets or the CO2 markets, which are used in abattoirs or to package salads, for instance. Fertilizer and CO2 being a byproduct of the gas production. So there were few years which resulted in intense cost pressures. If we are to look at where we were in last autumn, by then, gas prices had increased sevenfold. We had seen global commodity agricultural prices that had risen in double digits. Some of them, the vegetable oils were 70 to 80%, cereals close to 50%, so massive increases. But then every component of the cost had gone up. Labor had gone up, right? All the problems that we have on the labor market here. The pandemic meant that EU workers had decided to go home and then they didn't return. Then there were issues that are intrinsic just to the UK market. We've seen many people have retired. We are seeing many people outside of the labor market or inactive because they are sick, so they cannot actually work, which meant in turn that shortage of staff also pushed costs up. Packaging had gone up. The price of glass has doubled, for instance, but also of other packaging, cardboard, aluminium. So really, there was no element of cost that had not increased, and that had put such a huge pressure on the industry. that we have seen, for instance, last year, the number of insolvencies compared to 2019 had doubled in the industry. They were slightly higher in the UK too compared to 2019, but they were significantly below in terms of the rates of insolvencies. The UK insolvency rate is significantly below the industry rate. So the industry was impacted, again, disproportionately compared to the average UK business by these three shocks. Mm. And that is reflected in prices too.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, I mean, these shocks have been receding. The pandemic's over. I appreciate that there is restructuring required after a pandemic. The war in Ukraine is affecting food prices a bit less, I believe. Inflation as a whole is beginning to be got under control. The World Bank says wholesale prices are coming down globally, but some people, including the leader of the Liberal Democrats and the General Secretary of the Union, have said that supermarkets are profiteering in the face of inflation, that these prices are stubbornly high and that they really should have come down. Is there any evidence, Liliana, that to show that supermarkets are failing to pass on price reductions?
The way the retail works in the UK is that there are the four big chains, right? And then there are the discounters. When the discounters entered the market in 2012, when they really got gained market share, they have put so much pressure on the traditional retailers or the big retailers, that since then we have seen this intense price competition, which is probably one of the reasons why prices in the UK are also lower than in many European countries, because there is this intense competition in the between supermarkets. So also from an economics perspective, to have profiteering, that would mean that everybody would have to, because there is this intense price competition and they really, they compete on every P, that would mean that everybody would have to rise their prices at the same time, almost as if they were colluding, which is such a far-fetched scenario that I just cannot, no evidence for it, but that's,
I was just going to come in on a slightly, I suppose a sort of tangential, but slightly different, is that what we also have seen during the cost of living crisis and sort of post-pandemic as well, is that when there is the ambition to put something in place that is really, really good for consumers, that has been happening. So we saw a real expansion of the low-priced value kind of shopping goods. I think it was after Jack Monroe really sort of highlighted the really sort of big changes in price shifts that people were seeing on items at the lower end of market. And then I think it was Asda who brought in a really sort of big range of value priced products. While those prices have definitely been increasing, however, I would say more and more households have needed to rely on them. So I think we've seen sort of a combination of really good ambition to sort of change some offerings sort of through this cost of living crisis and saying, okay, what consumers actually need is this kind of product. But what we've also seen is that impact of rising inflation across the board, not just through food, but other things as well, which will lead to you needing to change your kind of spending habits and things on food, have meant that the need of those sort of value items has really risen up the income distribution. So you're seeing more and more households needing to rely on sort of those value goods, which makes it much, much harder for those on the lowest incomes to also access them as well. So I think there's sort of a combination of things. And then on your sort of initial point, while we've also seen that, wholesale prices are starting to come down and things are shifting, I think the key thing about sort of food price inflation is that while it's coming down, prices aren't falling. So prices are simply rising at a lower rate.
Yes, absolutely.
And so that's a really, really important thing that we keep remembering as we're sort of going through these conversations, is that actually prices aren't falling at all. Things are still becoming more expensive, just more slowly.
yeah, absolutely. And we mustn't forget, it's like the rate of acceleration, isn't it?
Exactly.
We're still accelerating.
Yeah.
But it's just the rate at which it's falling, which is
a we're not going at 100 k's an hour, it's 20.
Absolutely,
so it's, that's what we're aiming for.
Now, the Joseph Rowntree Foundation works to support, speed up the transition to more equitable and just future. You're battling poverty, essentially. Do you feel angry about food inflation?
Yes. So I think, do I feel angry about food inflation? I think I feel really angry that lower income households have been forced into positions where they can't afford the essentials, because our social security system in the UK is not robust enough that it guarantees that you won't be going without essentials if prices rise.
Yeah.
So at the moment, our universal credit is not based on whether or not you can afford your food, your heating, you know, basic communications, toiletries, cleaning products for your house and so on. It is simply based on a range of historical changes that have happened to the social security system over the, you know, last few decades. So what makes me really frustrated is that the government doesn't see it as enough of a priority to ensure that those on the lowest incomes in the UK will always be able to afford the essentials, because their incomes just simply aren't rising, you know, fast enough to keep up with these prices. So obviously it's gutting that the prices of essentials like food, like transport, like heating, rents, you know, mortgages now as well, are all going up at really, really, really quick rates. But it's how do you make sure that you're protecting those on the lowest incomes to ensure that they are not having to go without real basic items, or being forced into arrears or forced to take on really high cost credit in order to simply survive? Because, you know, the cost of living crisis is something that we're all feeling. But, you know, when we talk to those who are living in poverty, they've described it as a cost of surviving crisis, because that is the reality of sort of really impossible trade-offs that you're forced to make in the supermarket. You know, can I afford that loaf of bread, or is it heating today?
Yeah.
That's a very, very different situation.
And a horrific choice to have to make as well. Okay, so in May this year, the British Retail Consortium revealed that annual food inflation, according to their metrics, fell from 15.7% to 15.4%. Now, you've already said these prices are rising higher, but have you plotted out what the future might look like? And is there a sign of hope, or are these falls just too small to be of any significance to the most vulnerable people in our society, Rochelle?
Yeah, so I think small sort of percentage point changes are good signs that things are falling. Is that going to be of a huge amount of comfort to those who already can't afford their basic shop? I would say possibly not. I would say it's probably good news that it is falling. But as I said before, a lower level of food price inflation does not mean that prices are falling. It doesn't mean your income can stretch any further. It's actually still having to stretch to cover those additional costs because prices are still going up. So I would say it is probably, you know, for those who are really struggling already, too small to be of any significance at this point.
Yeah.
But the key thing is, I think what we're not going to see is that prices fall significantly, which means what we need to look at is like, what are the tools that we have to ensure that people can afford these items?
Yeah.
So I think that's where we sort of need to be looking for signs of hope is, right, what else can we do to make sure that everyone has got the tools and resources available to make sure that they will always be able to afford these goods, because they are essentials.
Yeah. So Liliana, from an industry point of view, when do you think we can expect to see some sort of levelling, some sort of controlling of wholesale and consumer food price rises?
Right. So our modelling suggests that we had reached peak food inflation, and from now on, we're just going to see it ease. Though it's true, easing of inflation is not the same thing with prices falling. So yes, it just means prices are just going up at a slower rate. And our modeling suggests that by the end of the year, food inflation will reach 10%, which, yes, it's half than what it was, right, compared to 19, but compared to 3 years ago, it's a massive, massive increase still. Well, that's because all those costs were of such magnitude. And also because of the way pricing happens, right? So indeed, many pressures on global markets have subsided now. I was talking about gas prices having seen increases of sevenfold last autumn compared to 2019. Now they are at about double the level of 2019. So, right, they have come down significantly compared to last fall. Global commodities measured by UN, they have also come down since March 22. The exception of sugar, all global commodities, agricultural commodities have seen a decline in prices. But we don't see that in our food shopping yet, because it takes a while for cost changes to actually filter through into retail prices.
Mm.
And we estimate that the time lag to be between 7 and 12 months. And it's easy to see it now. I mean, for consumers, for households to see it now. Oh, look, global food prices have fallen, but I don't see that in my shopping. But when the reverse had happened, which was our members, and this is also data from the ONS that can be accessed, costs had started rising in October 2020. But the retail prices only started rising in August 2021. Mm-hmm. So there was a 10-month lag where consumers have not seen prices go up, even if costs and, agricultural commodity prices had gone up. And that's because the way the pricing happens within the supply chain is using fixed-term contracts. So food manufacturers would contract out for 6 to 12 months different ingredients. And then normally, now has changed given the massive changes, but normally also with their clients, so with supermarkets or hospitality outlets, there are also fixed term contracts, which is great both for producers and for households because we don't see the impact of volatility. But it also means that the transmission of inflation is actually delayed in the system. So the declines that we are seeing in global markets are going to reach households, but it will take a while.
Gotcha. Yeah.
Again, right, the reverse happened a couple of years back.
Yeah. So, Rochelle, I mean, let's look at some of the support available to consumers, because we mustn't forget that a lot of people on benefits are already working. You know, they're just not paid enough to really support their families. So even if benefits go up, the wages that they're getting, which have not been tracking inflation, are going to drop anyway. So as you said, they're already squeezed, and a little bit of squeezing when you're in the lowest income brackets is devastating. So what can be done? How can we help low-income households right now? Is there support available?
Yeah. So I think I mentioned before, the government has put in place a range of cost of living payments that are available to households who are already on means-tested benefits, for example, universal credit. There are also additional payments that you can access, for example, £150 if you've got a family member with a disability or if you're a pensioner. So there is some good support coming through in that way. What I would note is that what we've found is that the cost of living payments of £300, so it's a total of £900 over sort of like this financial year for your means tested benefits, paid out in three tranches of around £300. Now, unfortunately, the incomes of those on universal credit are currently so squeezed that £300 does not last. You know,
vaporizes so quickly. I mean, it sounds like you've got a big family as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So our recent research and our most recent cost of living tracker conveniently coincided with the payout of that first cost of living payment. So we were able to assess the impact of if you were eligible for that payment and you had received it already, what kind of circumstances were your household finances like? And then similarly, if you hadn't received it, but you were eligible and expecting it, what did that look like? And what we found was that the majority of those who sort of had received it were using it to put food on the table and to pay down debt. So the proportion who were in arrears was, significantly different from those who hadn't received it yet, because it's going straight on the fact that households don't have enough money at the moment to keep up with their bills, like rent, council tax, energy, and so on, and also don't have enough money to put food on the table. So that's where that money is going, and it means it disappears immediately.
Yeah,
it does
absolutely not
last sort of, more than a month and 6 weeks. And that's what Citizens Advice is seeing. It's what the Trussell Trust is seeing in their food bank stats and so on. What we're seeing is that low-income households have got a really worrying proportion of those in negative budgets at the moment, because, again, there just simply isn't enough money to keep up. So what the Joseph Rowntree Foundation and the Trussell Trust are calling for at the moment is an essentials guarantee. So we're saying that the government needs to ensure that at a minimum, universal credit will cover your basic essentials so that you are never forced to go without. And that any deductions from those benefits, which put you in a more precarious position again, never fall below that level of being able to afford the essentials. Now, in addition to that, it's not just food prices that have been squeezing budgets of households at the moment. Housing costs have also played a really, really significant role in whether or not you know, you're more likely to be experiencing food insecurity, more likely to be in arrears, et cetera. But housing benefits have been frozen at rent levels from September 2019. So almost 4 years now.
Yeah,
if you
that's crazy,
know
isn't it?
Any renters or you're a renter yourself, you will know that your rent has absolutely gone up since then. Mm. And since that period, you know, asking rents across the country have gone up by around a fifth, and yet housing benefits have remained frozen. So, you know, if the government really wanted to make sure that more of people's income could actually be spent on things like food and their bills to make sure that they're not falling behind, that they're not running the risk of being evicted and not having to, you know, find housing in a market where it's just honestly just absolutely crackers at the moment, then, you know, we need to unfreeze housing benefits and make sure that they're realigned with market rents. So two things there on the social security system. The other thing is that those cost of living payments that are going out at the moment are only you're only eligible for them if you're already on means tested benefits like universal credit. But what we haven't seen is government run a massive take up campaign for all of the, you know, thousands, almost millions, I think, of households who are eligible for these benefits but aren't receiving them. Mm-hmm. So what we've also found in our data is that there are really worrying proportions of households on low incomes but not in receipt of means-tested benefits that are really struggling at the moment. And so it should absolutely be a priority to make sure that everyone who is eligible for that support can get it, and then they will also be able to get those additional sort of cost of living payments as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And what about the precariousness of the political environmental landscape? I mean, okay, we've talked about Brexit, the war in Ukraine, particular poor harvest, but you know, we're going to have to incorporate costs of sustainability implementation, climate mitigation factors, all these things. I mean, surely these need to be factored into how we look after people who are on the poorest level. And is that likely to happen, do you think, Rochelle?
It's what should happen. So, you know, your ability to pay your bills should not be based on sort of ad hoc decisions that are made when certain situations arise. Mm. And I think we've been hit by, you know, just such a multitude of things sort of happening over the last few years, from COVID to all of the different parts of the cost of living crisis as well. People are like, oh, right, we've just got on top of potentially our energy bills, and now my food bills are soaring, and my rent's happening, and my landlord's selling, and everything is just sort of going crazy all at once. But what it means is we need to build a robust social security system that is able to withstand shocks so that you're not consistently playing catch up. You know, you should always be able to afford to put enough food on the table, always be able to afford, you know, to get to school or get to work. That should never be a question. You know, you shouldn't be able to say, you know, it shouldn't be a question every day for millions of households across the country to say, do I put food on the table today or do I turn on my heating? So if we have a social security system that is robust enough to withstand those shocks, then that is a good thing. And it means you don't have to consistently say, right, how much additional support needs to go in? Is that enough? We can't afford it. It's too expensive to do that, or who are we targeting, or how do we target it? The social security system is designed to target for those who are struggling the most, and it's one of the best ways that we can do that. So we should use it and make sure that it is something that rolls with the punches, if you will, and is designed that as we move through our transition to net zero, you know, an inflation crisis, interest rates going up all the time, that we're able to withstand that. So I think precarity doesn't need to be the new normal. And what we're seeing at the moment is a really worrying sign of a horrendous new normal, but it's because we don't have those good systems in place to make sure that people are able to afford the basics when times get hard.
Yeah. Is there any hint that the current government is likely to tackle any of these things at a you know, a realistic scale? Or are they just going to leave the problem to the next administration, do you think?
I would like to think that any government who is in place at the moment would look at some of the statistics that are coming out of over 7 million low-income households going without essentials, almost 6 million experiencing food insecurity, 4.5 million in arrears, and say, this is not a UK that we want to live in and be responsible for. So I would say, I would hope that that is enough on its own to say, this is not okay, and these are the support systems that we have in place. Unfortunately, these are the same numbers that we have been looking at now for, you know, for years. Poverty rates have not been improving, and So I don't know, I would say my hopes are high, but my optimism is probably low.
Yes.
And it is, you know, it is expensive to make sure that we have the systems in place to make sure that people aren't going without essentials. But at the moment, those costs are being borne by those on the lowest incomes. And I would say that's an unacceptable, you know, placing of the burden of that should fall.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. Okay. Okay, let's roll back let's zoom out a little bit and discuss a little bit more kind of macroeconomics of food pricing. Now, Liliana, the UK has historically enjoyed low food prices. Is there an element here of the market correcting itself? Should you know, it's often talked about. Should food just cost more than we've been paying already anyway? And this is a separate conversation because to the poverty issue, because I think we're all pretty much in agreement that people can't afford what the price is now, and if they change, they still won't be able to afford it, and that help will have to come. But as an industry, is there a sense of the market correcting itself?
Well, I think as an industry, there are those big pressures that are still playing out. And yes, indeed, I mean, we will see in certain subsectors, right, the supply and demand will come to an equilibrium, and prices might mean that they will be much higher than whatever we were used to. I think there are two ways to think about this. One, if we are thinking of what have our food manufacturers done to deal with the substantial cost pressures we have seen recently? They tackled this pressure in a variety of ways, from cutting marketing and training expenses, which was probably the first approach. Our members tell us that they have reduced their ranges, that they have tried to become more energy efficient. They have tried to reorganize, to restructure their business to try to find efficiencies within the business, right? So find some savings. But also what we have seen is that many of them, specifically about 60% of the industry, has stated that they had either paused or canceled investment spending. Again, they couldn't pass on all these cost rises. And that supplements, that complements data from the ONS, which shows that about 72% of food manufacturers have absorbed costs in order to not to burden the consumers with all the size of cost increases. So that is sustainable for a while, but not in the long run. So, right, that something's got to give at some point.
Mm.
And also, if we look historically, when we've had other food crises, but they were only food crises, there weren't right, like with households, we have seen this barrage of costs and right going up at once. The same with businesses. So, in the past, when we had seen agricultural commodity prices going up, after a while, for instance, in 2010 or in 2014, those prices do come down, but they never come down at the level where they used to be.
Mm.
And one way to explain that is that if wages go up, usually wages don't come down, right? So at least the labor cost element will not decline. And then, as you were mentioning, probably different environmental regulations will also mean that we'll see certain cost components that will go up in the long run, and right, not temporarily, to address those issues.
Yeah. Okay. So, last question, really. I want to be positive about this. What can be done? What can be done? Not what is being done, I guess, but what should be done, maybe, by government, by industry, and by consumers as well, that's not being done already to help fight food inflation, to help mitigate these problems. What would you like to see happening, Rachelle?
Oh, I think I've talked a lot about what I think government could be doing at the moment in terms of better supporting those who ultimately need support with their incomes to meet these costs. I think, I don't know, I'm supportive of, you know, putting pressure on to make sure that there isn't profiteering, you know, in terms of food prices, and making sure that any savings are being passed on to consumers. So I guess continuing to make sure that pressure is happening, because ultimately that's going to have a more positive result for those purchasing at the end of the day. I think this is related, but not necessarily, you know, it's not necessarily designed to help tackle food inflation. But just to note that I guess like the Bank of England has obviously been putting up interest rates in response to rising inflation across the board. I would say that I would have proceeded. I mean, I'm not in the Bank of England. I don't sit on the Monetary Policy Commission.
You are for the next 10 seconds. Tell us what you do.
I wouldn't have put rates up quite as high, quite so quickly. I would have waited to see what the impact has been of rate rises to date, because actually those rate rises are having a massive hit on those with mortgages. It's flowing through, you know, whether or not we like it, into the rental market as well. Mm-hmm. It's also flowing through into those with unsecured lending, so credit cards, overdrafts, other types of lending. Huge declines are currently happening so that lower income households can't access more affordable credit. Mm-hmm. So all of this has massive flow-on impacts for how much money you then have available to spend on food too. So I guess in general, taking a back step from just food, because so many other prices are going up and at the same time, all of that needs to be looked at quite carefully. And I guess I would just advise caution on how quickly we are kind of enforcing other costs to be going up at the same time, which is having a big impact on household finances.
Absolutely. Okay, Liliana, any hint of optimism in terms of food inflation from you? And what do you think could be done to help fight food inflation?
So what we would like to see from the government is not to add extra costs and sometimes maybe unnecessary costs to the industry.
Some examples of what those costs might be?
Sure. So for instance, there is the target operating model, which is being discussed, and the labeling issue to label products which are to be consumed in the UK, right? Not for EU. It turns out it's quite expensive, and it would be quite an amount of red tape and bureaucracy, which is costly and unnecessary. Also, if we are looking at some other kind of regulations, the Extended Producer Responsibility, the EPR Act, which is aimed to reduce and to reform the packaging recycling. So basically pretty much everything we put in the bin, the plastic packaging, which is something with which the industry is on board. So they would like to see an uptake in plastic recycling. But the way the law is formulated right now, it actually does not achieve that that outcome. It just puts extra burdens. So we would like to see a reformulation of the law to actually address the intended goal of the law, to not only get the reduced packaging plastics, but also to not to have unnecessary financial burdens, right? And then we would like some help with the labor shortages. Again, the labor market is very tight and our industry reports shortages across all roles and skills. And if the government could maybe make the apprenticeship levy a little bit more flexible, or help with some programs to support automation in the industry, that would be great and would obviously help with not having at least bigger costs and therefore keep inflation at bay at as much as it is at bay. Yeah.
Fantastic. Okay, well, all very good ideas. Okay, well, that's been incredibly informative, and you've made a potentially dull and very complicated subject absolutely fascinating. So I really appreciate your input. So Liliana, Daniela and Rachelle, Erica, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed that episode of the Food Matters Live podcast. Now, we'd like you to join us in our new initiative, Sustainable Food Week, where we're celebrating the influential people changing the future of food. There are a number of ways to get involved. We've got a digital digest, an in-person forum, and podcast opportunities. It's happening between the 18th and 24th of September. But if you want to be involved, you need to act now. Find out more on the Food Matters Live website or email us at info@foodmatterslive.com. And thank you so much for listening.